Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, voters in Tucson are deciding whether or not to increase their sales taxes.
And the Arizona State Museum holds 13,000 years of history, but it's closed until its operators can agree who should pay for repairs.
But first, Prescott area Republican Representative Quang Nguyen wants to amend the state constitution to keep his fellow lawmakers from getting out of traffic tickets. Right now, state lawmakers are immune from civil traffic violations while the legislature is in session. His bill would do away with that. Though only for things like speeding tickets, lawmakers would still be exempt from arrest for, quote, treason, felony, and breach of the peace. If he can get his fellow lawmakers to sign on, it would go to voters next year. The move comes as lawmakers keep making headlines for playing that legislative immunity card, from former Senator Justine Wadsack to Senator Jay Kaufman, who was going 89 miles per hour in a 65 zone. The trooper recognized him as a lawmaker and didn't give him a ticket. And Nguyen's own seatmate, Republican Mark Fincham, invoked his legislative immunity last month to get out of a traffic ticket after he was clocked going 48 miles per hour in a 30 zone. The law has been around since our state's founding, when there were concerns that corrupt cops might pull a legislator over to prevent them from voting at the Capitol. But Nguyen told me that's not an issue today.
You know, we keep hearing about legislative immunity being misused. And so I sort of got to a point where I'm a little bit frustrated with the black eyes given to the institution that I love so much, which is the House of Representatives and the legislature. It's such an honor to be down here representing constituents from all around the states. And we just need to pay a little bit more attention to who we are as representatives and not misuse immunity just because we have it. And that's my main motivation.
And it's interesting. Can you talk a little bit about some of the history of this immunity and why this is included? It's kind of from a long time ago when it was sort of the Wild West out here, right?
Yeah, correct. And this is my fifth year. And personally, I've never been pulled over because of a vote. I don't know any of the other legislators within the legislature being pulled over for a vote or preventing a vote from happening. Then you can go back to 20 years, 30 years, and 40 years, and I haven't been able to find anything, and maybe somebody else could help me out. But I think it's time for us to go away with it, because it's only drawing negative attention to the institution. And so I think if we were to go away with the immunity, then you and I wouldn't have this conversation at all, would we?
And you think it's giving you a black eye, basically, lawmakers in general, the institution as a whole?
I think so. You know, every single time an event happens and somebody pulled the immunity issue, then you have a large population. For example, I won't talk about people outside of my district, but people inside my district are saying, why is this person deserving immunity? And when I have the same traffic ticket, I have no say. I have to go to court. I have to pay for it. And I think if we are as lawmakers and we are not lawbreakers, we should live under the same rules and law that we are creating every single day down here for the general population. And I think it's a lot of it is about fairness. Lauren, I just want to make sure you understand that I'm not going after any particular legislator at all. All I want to do is bring integrity back to the institution. That's all.
Right. OK, so let me ask you about the reception this proposal has gotten from your colleagues, though. I mean, it's tough to ask lawmakers to give up a privilege that they've enjoyed for some time. You drive a lot to get to the Capitol, too. I mean, like, what have folks had to say about this at the Capitol there?
Well, there are a lot of people where, you know, some legislators started to push back a little bit. And I understand it. It's an immunity. And people actually said, don't remove the fence if you don't understand why the fence was put up in the first place. And my comment back to that is, hey, listen, dinosaurs extinct. We can actually take the fence down because they're not here to go after us anymore. I'm doing 93 miles each way every single day. That's
Wow, yeah.
180 miles. And so what does that mean for me? I'm actually moving immunity from me, who is doing, the most driving on the freeway and have more opportunities to be pulled over than anybody else.
So your bill would only add traffic violations to the very short
Correct.
list of exceptions to this
Well,
immunity clause, right?
that's it. You said it right. It only adds to traffic violations. We still can't be arrested, except for, felony or treason. And it's all listed in Section 6. It's not removing the immunity altogether. And in fact, in 2019, Governor Ducey did ask legislators to remove the immunity clause altogether. I'm
Yeah.
not doing that. I'm just adding the silly traffic violations, and it'll just stop the conversation.
So what immunity do you think is appropriate? I mean, none of this applies to criminal cases, but within the civil realm.
Hey, listen, I would live without it. So let me just put it that way. I can live every day without the immunity clause all removed together. We are lawmakers, for crying out loud. Why do we protect ourselves from breaking certain laws? I mean, it just makes no sense to me. This is 2025. This is not 1912 anymore, or 1917, when people were driving the Model A and being pulled over. Not that just, it makes no sense. Lauren, I want to bring up this point too. If I were to be pulled over by a law enforcement officer, I would just pull out my cell phone and say, "Mr. Speaker, House of Representatives, I'm going to be a couple of hours late. So if there's an important, super important bill, could you please hold it for a couple of hours until I make it?" I mean, it's that simple. It's not a big deal. It just gives the optics of we are above the law, and I just don't like that.
So this would go to voters if it passes through the legislature. Do you think it would have popular support?
Absolutely. If I were a betting person, which I'm not, I would say probably 90% plus would vote to approve this HCR.
You think it'll get that far and through the legislature to the voters?
I have no idea what people wake up and think about, things in the morning, but I wake up, the first thing I think about is I'm on the right side of the grass. God loves me. And now let's go down there and do something to make Yavapai County and LD1 a much better place to live. And this immunity thing doesn't make us look good.
All right, that is Republican Representative Quang Nguyen joining us. Thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
Tucson voters are deciding whether or not to approve a half-cent sales tax increase to pay for public safety, emergency response, and community services, among other things. Prop 414 would increase the city's sales tax from 2.6% to 3.1% for a decade. Early voting is underway. Election day is March 11th. With me to talk about the campaigns and how the election is shaping up is Caitlin Schmidt, editor and publisher of Tucson Spotlight. And Caitlin, let's start with who's behind Prop 414. Who's supporting it?
So the Prop 414 is backed by the city of Tucson. They are really saying that we need this sales tax push to fund this Safe and Vibrant City initiative to the tune of $800 million. And we're actually seeing, in addition to just, the city council, who you would expect to be backing it because they have to, people are kind of coming out of the woodwork. I've been getting emails every couple of days from the Yes on 414 campaign about who's endorsing it, which is including state senators, representatives, former representatives, the mayor of South Tucson. So it's kind of widely backed by those in the political scene.
And in terms of those who are not supporting it, what are their arguments? Why do they think this is not the right move?
So the big concern that we're hearing from opponents about Prop 414 is the amount of money that's allocated to police. And police technology and equipment, which is roughly 65%. So, the defund the police crowd, but also the people who are just really concerned about policing trends that harm marginalized communities, people of color, they are not in support of this. And we're also hearing from members of the the social service community that have been working with unhoused community members for years that this is not the solution. They've been asking for more money for years for public services, public restrooms, shelter, housing. And this proposition doesn't do it. It allocates less than 35% to that, and not even all of that will go to affordable housing and those kinds of services.
So it sounds like at least some, if not most, of the critics of this are not people who say the area doesn't need the money. It's that they don't like how the money is divvied up.
Yep, that seems to be the opinion. You know, and if you look at the breakdown, it doesn't on the city's campaign materials and on the Yes on 414 campaign materials, it doesn't overtly say 65% of this will go to police. The breakdown looks a little bit different. But, you know, these categories are enhanced emergency response, technology investments, capital investments for first responders. Those are all things that are going to fund police and emergency response. And these include like tactical vehicles, widespread surveillance. So there's some concerns about how the information that's collected will be used and who will have access to it. So it sparked a lot of concerns.
Are there any people concerned about the increase in taxes and how the rate is going up and what that might do for the economy?
You know, I haven't heard as much about that. You know, it is a half cent sales tax increase. We have these every couple years. They tend to grandfather out once they lapse. So that hasn't been the bulk of the argument. But mostly what we've been hearing is it's just a way to secretly slip in more money for police.
Have any supporters addressed the concerns of opponents in terms of how the money is going to be divided up and maybe what law enforcement will be doing with it?
Yeah, you know, the city is trying to address that. I haven't seen, you know, honestly, the city manager just wrote an op-ed to the Star the other day and did not address that at all, which was surprising to me. So really, I haven't seen them directly address that. You know, they're trying to say that, you know, that the surveillance will be used to address violent criminals. It won't be used to track everyday citizens. But I think just the historical implications of what surveillance and who's been, you know, targeted by the criminal justice system are kind of looming in the forefront of people's minds.
For the city, like, what are they saying the impact would be if this does not pass?
I mean, they're saying, you know, with the federal funding that is no longer available, pandemic relief funds and a lot of other federal funding in question, they're really stressing that we need this money in order to make a dent in the affordable housing crisis. Things are really in flux. A lot of the priorities that the city has pushed funding towards over the past few years are not really in line with the federal government anymore, right? I mean, we've worked towards environmental justice, a lot of environmental initiatives here that doesn't seem to be priorities from above. And so I think they're concerned that if we don't pass this, we will have a harder time finding funding for the things that we prioritize here in Tucson versus what is prioritized around the country as a whole.
That's interesting. So, like, how engaged is Tucson in this? Is this something people are talking about in day-to-day life?
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of chatter on social media. Both the Yes on Prop 414 and No on Prop 414 campaigns are really active. We're getting in emails every couple days, you know, about who's endorsing. There was actually a press conference at City Hall last Friday. So the campaigns are definitely out and about. I've seen a lot of chatter on social media, and I've heard from a lot of community groups who are really trying to get their point out. But as we know, people talking about something doesn't necessarily translate to them showing up at the polls. And historically, city-only elections are really low turnout.
Are the two sides like evenly funded in terms of the resources they have to get their message out? Or is one like, is the yes side or the no side? Does one of them have considerably more money than the other to get their message out?
I haven't looked at the campaign finance, but the business community and, you know, I suspect given the people who are backing Prop 414 that there's more money in those coffers. The chairman for Prop 414, the Yes campaign, is Patrick DeConcini, who is a very well-known local businessman. He's part of the legacy DeConcini family. You know, this is getting a lot of support from groups like the Tucson Crime Free Coalition, who have really been pushing the city hard to address these issues. So I suspect that this side has more funding than the other.
Got it. And has there been any polling on this? Like, is there a sense of how Tucsonans feel about this?
I haven't seen any polling. You know, it's interesting because our city officials have to be really careful. They can't say anything during the mayor and council meetings that could count as campaigning for
Yeah.
this. So what's been interesting in the recent meetings is we've seen a lot of people come and address them during call to the audience. Most of them on the no side, overwhelmingly on the no side. And, you know, in those situations, the city can't respond. But they are really active campaign-wise. I'm seeing more signs from the Yes campaign, seeing a lot more activity in terms of press conferences and that sort of thing from the Yes side. So it's, you know, it's tough to say.
All right. That is Caitlin Schmidt, editor and publisher of Tucson Spotlight. Caitlin, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the little-known story of a Sonoran, Joan of Arc.
They thought she was dead, and they prepared a funeral for her. And she woke up in the middle of this funeral. She literally sat up upright and looking around and what's going on here? And it was, you know, it was a miracle.
An author takes us through the life of a healer turned icon of the Mexican Revolution.
But first, this week, we're sharing a special investigative series on autistic patients at the Arizona State Hospital. The series is called Overwhelmed. KJZZ's Amy Silverman and Athena Ankra spent 6 months speaking to incarcerated patients inside the hospital and their families and lawyers outside in what they described as a secretive and psychologically damaging institutions for patients with autism. Silverman and Ankra also reviewed hundreds of pages of state audits, inspection reports, meeting minutes, and medical records, watched legislative testimony, and interviewed medical professionals and autism specialists from across the country. The show's Amy Silverman starts this report.
Okay, are we all on?
Yes, hi, I'm here.
Matt?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay,
hey, Matt,
good.
It's Amy.
Hi, Amy, how are you?
I'm good, how are you doing?
I'm surviving, barely.
Matt Solon is overwhelmed. He's been a patient at the Arizona State Hospital since April 2020, found guilty of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Because he was found to be guilty except insane, Solon was sent to ASH, as it's often known, instead of prison. The idea is to rehabilitate rather than punish, so that patients can someday rejoin society and lead fulfilling, safe, productive lives. Instead, Solon and others say ASH is making them worse. According to state hospital medical records Solon provided to KJZZ, the 35-year-old has been diagnosed with antisocial and narcissistic personality disorders. As a child, he was also diagnosed with autism. It's the lack of accommodations for his autism, Solon says, that is causing him distress.
Well, if I could sum it up in one word, I would use the word torture.
It took weeks to arrange the timing of the phone call with Solon's lawyer, and once we get on the phone, it's easy to hear what he means when he talks about sensory overload.
Every single room and hallway and corridor, from the day room to the treatment rooms to the bedrooms to the bathrooms, they just amplify noise, and the echo here is horrible. So no matter where I go in here, I can't escape the sensory overstimulation that all this noise and motion and commotion causes.
Between patients, staff, walkie-talkies, and TVs, the place is so loud, he says, that Solon has willed himself nocturnal, sleeping through the day and waking up at night when it's quiet and there's less stimulation.
On the average day when my sleep schedule's not interrupted for one reason or another, I would sleep all day. I would wake up around dinner. The staff would save my lunch and dinner for me, so I'd eat them both at once. And then I would get on the computer, and I would stay on the computer and do paperwork and research. I spend probably 12, 13 hours a day studying, reading, and writing computer code. I just do that all night until the sun comes up, and then usually before breakfast is served, I'll go to my room. I'll take out my little game player, watch a cartoon until I can't keep my eyes open, and go to sleep and sleep the rest of the day.
In a statement provided to KJZZ, the Arizona Department of Health Services said, quote, quiet rooms, weighted blankets, and noise-canceling headphones are incorporated into care plans for patients when clinically indicated. But Solon's medical records from August of last year show that a nurse practitioner at ASH ordered accommodations for him, including noise-canceling headphones. And a legal appeal filed by his lawyer mentions prior medical orders for soothing baths.
There's one of the shower rooms has a bathtub in it to help with grounding and cooling off. And over the last, 4 months, the hospital imposed a bunch of sweeping changes that haven't made much sense, but they effectively came in and said the bathtubs are permanently closed, nobody can use them, and shut off the water to them. They seized my headphones when they raided the whole hospital after revamping their contraband policy. I'm basically down out of all of my coping tools.
Solon was also unsuccessful recently in suing the hospital to allow him access to his therapy dog. The dog died before the case could be resolved.
Last fall, Solon was charged with aggravated assault against an ASH employee. His attorney, Holly Giesel, says this is not the first time one of her clients with autism has been punished for acting out after being denied accommodations. She says hospital staff are undertrained and struggle to de-escalate when a patient has an outburst. Because diagnosing mental health conditions is more of an art than a science, it's hard to know how many people across the U.S. with serious mental illness also have autism. The study of dual diagnoses is relatively new. Researchers have only begun to break the surface in the last few years.
In this series, we'll hear from two other patients in the forensic unit at ASH who report similar experiences to Solon's, as well as the sister of a former patient who says her autistic brother emerged from ASH much sicker than when he went in. Attorneys representing patients at ASH say substandard treatment is widespread, and advocates for the autism community say the place is shrouded in secrecy, making it impossible to know what is really going on. The Department of Health Services and Governor Katie Hobbs' office declined to answer any specific questions for this story. Repeated requests for a tour of the state hospital were denied. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Amy Silverman.
And I'm Athena Ankara.
KJZZ is part of the Mental Health Parity Collaborative, a group of newsrooms that are covering stories on mental health care access and inequities in the U.S. The partners on this project include the Carter Center and newsrooms in select states across the country.
The Arizona State Museum is a sweeping tribute to Arizona history, going back 13,000 years. Its vast archives grow exponentially every year, and it houses one of the most important collections of anthropology in the Southwest. But since last year, it's been closed. Its operators say the building is in need of such repairs that it's unsafe for people to go in it. But the $50 million in repairs they say it needs to reopen were indefinitely tabled by the Arizona Board of Regents in September. And it all has to do with the financial hole that its host, the University of Arizona, is trying to dig itself out of. Carolina Cuellar reported it all for Arizona Luminaria in Tucson, and I spoke with her more about it.
So this building holds like 13,000 years of regional and historical artifacts. It's also the oldest and the largest anthropological museum in the Southwest. And it contains a lot of Native American materials and culturally significant artifacts that we hold dear and are necessary to, you know, keep the history of Arizona and make it accessible for the public. Additionally, approximately 2 cargo vans of archaeological research material is added to the museum's archives annually.
Wow.
So while they have like a series of materials that they're already preserving, the process is actually ongoing, and they need to have places to store these materials that are not only like big enough to hold them, but that also provide the proper care. And that's temperature, humidity control. It has to be a very specific environment.
Right. That's always true for archives, right? And this building, the museum itself and the archives, has been closed, though, for a year or so. Tell us why.
Yeah, of course. So the Arizona State Museum has not always been in this building, which is called the Raymond H. Thomas Building. but it did move into that building in the 70s. But by that time, the building was already old. And so when the museum moved in pretty quickly, the director of the museum was like, this building is in need of upgrades and maintenance. And this was in the 80s. So since then, the building has continued to deteriorate without any of the necessary improvements. So they're sort of at a point where the building is in a way falling apart. It's not safe for people to even visit right now because of the asbestos, because of the conditions of the infrastructure, like the pipes and the HVAC.
So some big problems that need to be fixed and that it sounds like haven't been fixed for quite some time. The museum requested funding for these fixes and got turned down, right? By who?
By the Arizona Board of Regents. So in September, late September, during their general meeting, John Arnold, who is the chief financial officer for the University of Arizona, spoke to the board about needing funding for this project, which has already been underway. Like they've been preparing for it for a year.
Yeah.
So the museum closed in August in preparation for these improvements. And just a month after, when CFO Arnold presented the package before the Arizona Board of Regents, there was, I think, a lot of like hesitancy because the original proposal was to fund this $50 million through system revenue bonds, mm-hmm. which are actually sustained by student tuition. And the, as you, I think a lot of people know, the University of Arizona is sort of in a precarious financial position
right.
where they're working really hard to recover from that. And so I sense a lot of pushback from the Board of Regents, particularly due to that. And in addition, there's sort of a disagreement with who should be responsible for funding this
mm-hmm.
because it is a state museum, but it is on the property of the University of Arizona.
Right.
So while they tabled indefinitely the package for those improvements, they wanted to get legal advice or consult the state as to whether that should even be on them to begin with.
Hmm. So there's this battle over who is responsible to fix this place. They might turn to the state, it sounds like. What has the university had to say about this? As you said, this is all kind of tied to the fact that the university is in kind of a deep financial hole they're trying to get out of.
Right. But, you know, within the university, you have the Arizona State Museum Council, who is very adamant that these improvements need to be done. And again, this museum is very important, not just because of its artifacts, but because of its place in Arizona and letting Arizonans access, you know, these materials mm-hmm. and all of this wonderful history. A lot of classes used to take field trips here. I've heard from multiple people that they remember going to the Arizona State Museum when they were younger. So on one hand, you have the museum advocates who are saying this is something that needs to be invested in and ABOR needs to figure it out. Because additionally, I think the argument is that state statute puts the onus of managing the museum on the Board of Regents. Mm. And I think that's a basis for a lot of the frustration from specifically the people who are on the museum council. In terms of administrative level, higher level, I sense sort of a neutrality. There, I think, was an understanding that the funding was happening in a difficult situation, like requesting this funding. So mm-hmm. John Arnold also offered that they are happy to wait until, you know, the state comes back with their response as to who the responsibility is. So I wouldn't say there's a general consensus on what the perspective is on doing this, but there is definitely a very strong sentiment from the side of the museum advocates that this needs to be something that's funded and the responsibility is on the Arizona Board of Regents, despite them saying that it's on the state.
Right. And there were comments made by some of the people on the Board of Regents, right, when this was tabled, saying, you know, I'd rather see this money go elsewhere, right?
Yeah. So Regent Brewster said specifically that he'd rather see the money go towards, quote, polishing the young people of Arizona rather than having to have the UA, quote, stand up and deliver because the state has ignored this project for years and years. And
wow.
That sentiment, I think, was echoed by multiple regents during the meeting.
So where does that leave these massive archives, the things that need to be temperature controlled in there, the things we don't want to lose to history, right? Are they in danger at this point?
That is a great question, and I have not been able to get a straight answer. I know that in the year leading up to that closure, there was a movement of artifacts so that they would be safe while this maintenance is underway. So I think presumably they have moved some of the materials in a place where they can be contained.
Mm.
But I'm not sure how long they can keep it there. And I'm also not sure whether those conditions that they're in are good for the long-term preservation of these artifacts.
Okay. The museum says at this point it expects to stay closed until at least the end of next year. Do we know if that is the end of the timeline or if it could be much longer?
No, we don't know. And again, like if they don't have the funding, then it's hard to see how they could reopen, especially since all of the maintenance and the repairs were contingent on having that funding package.
Okay. We will leave it there for now. Lots to watch for. Carolina Cuellar is a reporter for Arizona Luminaria joining us from Tucson. Carolina, thank you for coming on. Appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Last year, the path to FDA authorization of the psychedelic drug MDMA for treatment of PTSD hit an unexpected snag. During a hearing before an advisory committee, which would have helped clear the way for a drug company called Lykos to use MDMA in concert with psychological treatments, a series of speakers stood up to give some unexpected testimony. Their accounts raised concerns about the ethics of some of the therapists in Lykos's MDMA clinical trials, and the committee ended up voting not to let Lykos proceed with FDA authorization. It later emerged that all of these speakers were affiliated with a shadowy organization called Symposia, and that their intentions were complicated. Andrew Jacobs is a reporter for The New York Times, and he wrote about this bizarre plot twist. Jacobs recently spoke with the show's Sam Dingman.
So one of the people that helped torpedo Lykos's bid was named, and I apologize if I'm pronouncing this wrong, is it Nez Devino?
Neshe Devino, and the organization that they run called Symposia, you know, was widely believed to have played a role kind of in the failure of this application. Hard to prove definitively, but my article sort of tries to make the case that they did play some role.
And Neshe Devino, if I'm not mistaken, it's Dr. Neshe Devino, but Dr. Devino is not a medical doctor. I believe they're a senior lecturer in the writing program at Johns Hopkins, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. Neshe Devino is a writing teacher at Johns Hopkins, has done some work in bioethics, and sort of self-describes as a psychedelics bioethics expert.
So Dr. Devino comes to this public hearing and makes this very inflammatory accusation that Lykos is a, quote, therapy cult. What proof, if any, did they offer for that accusation?
I would say zero. I think that's their opinion about the therapy part of the application. And several members of this organization, Symposia, testified at that hearing. None identified themselves as being affiliated with this organization, Symposia. So it gave the appearance that you had seven or eight separate, you know, experts who were all sort of singing the same tune. And I think that helped create this atmosphere of doubt that the ADCOM members seemed to have felt there was a lot of red flags here and they couldn't approve.
Yeah. Well, so tell us, this group Symposia, who are they?
So Symposia is a nonprofit. They sort of describe themselves as a media organization, whistleblowers, watchdogs, that broadly speaking are for decriminalization of psychedelics, that also what's known as harm reduction, just making it safer for people who do use psychedelics, because you are, you know, in a vulnerable position when you are taking a drug like that. And there have been, you know, plenty of cases of sexual abuse and unethical behavior during those journeys. On the other hand, they also have a very distinct sort of leftist philosophy about the commercialization of psychedelics, and they do not support this regulatory process, which will lead to commercializing these drugs, i.e., you know, someone will make money off them.
Yeah. Well, you bring up a very puzzling irony in this story, which is that, if I'm not mistaken, Dr. Devino themselves is a survivor of sexual trauma who credits psychedelics with helping their recovery, right?
Correct. And I think you could say everyone who is allied, affiliated with Symposia has a similar story. They are all pro-psychedelic. Many of them have been aided by psychedelic healing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is one of the things that's really fascinating to me about your piece is there's this sort of pretzel logic in effect, because as you point out, a lot of the folks who work with Symposia have themselves been victimized by these really traumatic situations that psychedelics have been very helpful to them in overcoming, but they're also aware of the potential abuses of the relationship between a psychedelic counselor and a victim of trauma, like what they've endured. Mm-hmm. And ostensibly, federal regulation would help make that less likely, but they're also against regulation and commercialization.
Yeah, I think you sort of hit the nail on the head. It's a very hard argument to wrap your head around. A lot of people who supported this application were crestfallen by the rejection because they felt like with all the flaws in the application to the FDA, they believe that they could have been sort of cleaned up and fixed post-approval, especially given, you know, there's 13 million Americans with PTSD and there's really not very good treatment. I'll say the Symposia, in its defense, said that they believe we need to get this right the first time. It's so momentous that that's what they would say. Mm-hmm. They would say they're protecting the vulnerable.
Yeah. And I mean, did you get a sense from them in your interactions with representatives of Symposia what that would look like?
Well, I will say that it's easier to figure out what Symposia is against compared to what they're for. I didn't really get a good sense from them what their vision is besides decriminalizing psychedelics. The one case of unethical behavior that was raised involved a patient in the clinical trials of MDMA. A woman who was taking the MDMA, and she was in a session with two therapists, a husband and a wife. And while she's on her journey, as it were, she was very distressed. And these two therapists sort of cuddled and kind of spooned her at one point, sort of trying to calm her down. And that is, generally not considered.
Obviously, not ethical.
But what happened after that is that patient ended up having a relationship with the male therapist, and later she sued him for sexual assault. Obviously, a very complicated story here. But the quick version is that MAPS did acknowledge this incident. It was reported and it was sort of handled back in 2019. But that has not stopped Symposia from alleging that there are other cases there. There's other things being hidden, but they have yet to sort of produce anyone who can confirm those allegations. So they generally have sort of trafficked in, I guess, innuendo and without providing much concrete detail.
Right. So because there was this one situation that was disclosed where trust was abused, they're basically using that to suggest that there must be many more.
Correct. I will just note, this was an unusual situation where you had the ADCOMS people, advisory committee people. They did not, except for one of the 11 people, none of them had expertise in psychedelics. It's such a new therapy. And so I think those people didn't really fully understand what they were looking at. And that's generally a wide agreement in the field, that based on the questions and the remarks they were making, they didn't quite grasp what was before them. They had expertise in certain slices of what was before them, for example, addiction, PTSD, but none had that sort of special, that precise expertise.
All right. Well, Andrew Jacobs is a health and science reporter at the New York Times and wrote about Symposia and its impact on MDMA-assisted therapy, which we'll be keeping a close eye on going forward. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. In the spring of 2020, Robin Foster was teaching at a university in Virginia. And like much of the rest of the education world during the early days of the pandemic, her classes went remote. But she didn't want to continue doing that into the following school year. And not knowing what would happen, Foster decided to head west to less populated areas. She ended up in Wyoming that fall for a few weeks and liked it so much, the next summer she visited Montana. While she was there, she figured she'd uncover a local story nobody really knew and write about it.
while I was staying near Yellowstone that summer of 2021, I did some digging around and discovered that, in fact, at Yellowstone National Park, the first full-time female park ranger was hired in the early 1920s, a local woman named Marguerite Lindsley. And there was a collection of her, some papers and some correspondence at the Yellowstone Archives. And so that's where, you know, I started digging around and looking into her story. And that's really where the first chapter came out of, was that first summer out west in Montana.
That story became the first in Foster's new book called Grit and Ghosts, following the trail of eight tenacious women across a century. She decided to go from place to place across the West and Southwest to find the story of a woman who people probably didn't know about. She was looking specifically for stories of resilience and tenacity, especially, she says, since life in the early part of the pandemic was so chaotic. She wanted inspirational stories of women confronted with unique obstacles and how they got through them. One of those women is Teresa Urrea. She was at one point dubbed the Mexican Joan of Arc. And when I spoke with Robin Foster, we talked about Urrea's life, which was an interesting one, starting pretty much right at birth.
Yeah, so she was born, this goes back to 1873. So this was, you know, almost about 150-ish years ago. She was born in Sonora, Mexico. Her mother was very young, a local indigenous woman. Her father was the son of a wealthy landowner. And she grew up in poverty with her mother and her aunt for her childhood. And when she was about 15, her father brought her into, you know, the big house on the ranch with his wife and his legitimate children, and then raised her as his daughter there with the rest of his family. And then something happened to her when she was about 15. The way reporters talked about it later, the story was that she had been jilted by a lover and she was heartbroken and she went into this sort of coma-like trance. I mean, obviously, that wasn't the story. If it wasn't, she was in this sort of coma-like state for about 3 months. They really didn't know what to make of it.
Hmm.
And her father, in fact, thought that she had died. And the housekeeper, who was also the healing woman in the household, they thought she was dead. And they planned, her father and Wila, the healer in their home, prepared a funeral for her. And she woke up in the middle of this funeral. She literally sat up,
wow,
upright and looking around and what's going on here. And it was, you know, it was a miracle. And she told everybody who would listen that this vision she had had when she was what they thought she had died. And she had this vision that she went, you know, she sees herself drifting and she meets the Virgin of Guadalupe, comes to her and says, it's not time for you yet. You need to go back because you have these gifts, these gifts of healing. And you can go back and be a source of good mainly for the indigenous peoples, the Yaqui and the Mayo Indians who lived in the region. And then so overnight, she was a sensation. Pilgrims flocked to her from all across northern Mexico and the borderlands. And sooner rather than later, the President Diaz administration and the church were not at all happy with this very young woman sort of amassing this following and quickly being labeled a patron saint. And she was exiled to Arizona that year with her father.
So she clearly used that vision of the Virgin Guadalupe to decide what she was going to do next. Did it seem as though she had success as a healer? I mean, did she get training at some point, or did she mostly just use what she had learned during this vision to try to do what she was doing?
She had training back at home in her father's household with Wila, who was the household healer. The power of touch was, by her accounts, a gift from God, that she just had this power of this healing touch. And eventually the indigenous peoples found her, that the Mexican state wasn't going to say what happened to her. They didn't want her to become a martyr. They certainly didn't want, you know, this trail of pilgrims going after her, but her whereabouts were found. She lived in Tubac for a while and in the Tucson area. And people did find her and continued to see her for healing and for treatments. And everyone said she was quite effective. And the papers, and we know this because the papers in Mexico, but also in the United States, reported on her almost continuously. This is about a decade or two leading up to the Mexican Revolution. So there's a lot of tensions and antagonisms between the indigenous populations that's being expelled from their native lands in northern Mexico or killed And people did flock to her, continue to see her and claim that she had healing powers. But then what happens, the press went further with that. She was soon cited as instigating a lot of these raids and these attacks when the Mayo and Yaqui soldiers would attack, for example, the customs houses along the borders. And they were calling for her capture. You know, newspapers called for, you know, she must be captured. She's going to be killed. She's going to be hanged. So this aspect of her reputation began to trump that of her as a healer.
Well, so obviously that reputation was not super helpful with the Mexican government, but I wonder what it did for the people who were coming to see her for healing purposes.
Well, she eventually left Tubac in Tucson and she moved to El Paso. And eventually she had to leave. She was too close to the action. She and her father moved to Clifton, Arizona, and things did quiet down. It seems once she moved away from the border, the number of pilgrims who came to her for healing did lessen to an extent. And she really hoped to sort of quiet things down and have just sort of a normal, you know, she says, I'm not a saint. I'm not a saint. I'm just a woman. And I think she really wanted to have just a regular life. She thought she fell in love with a man nobody really knew about. And on her wedding night, he shot her and tried to kill her. He tried to kill her family.
So what lessons then do you take from her life? Or maybe how do you see her story as being relevant to today?
Teresa Uria and all of the women in Grit and Ghost, I was looking to find these stories that would offer me inspiration and solace, you know, during a chaotic time. And I was looking for examples of women who had gone through, you know, certain obstacles. And I've kept that with me. I mean, I keep that close to my heart, but things have for me at least settled down the past, you know, year or two after the wave of the first, you know, couple of years of the COVID pandemic. Things have quieted down, but now we're entering a state where, you know, the world is, you know, we're potentially in an unrecognizable flux again with a new administration coming in January. And, you know, we don't really know what that's going to look like. And I've been thinking that none of the women in Grit and Ghost had even close to the rights that I have today. Most of these women they didn't have the right to vote. They didn't really have a right to legal autonomy. None of these women could get credit in their name. They couldn't seek a no-fault divorce. There was no such thing as marriage equality. And so I'm sort of trying to assess, you know, what's going to happen for us the next 4 years. And I think these women had so much less in the way of rights and autonomy that we have today, but none of them stopped. None of them gave up. And, you know, they never said, okay, you win. I'll stop. I'm done. That just didn't happen. So there's always going to be a next thing, right? You don't get to a place of sort of peace and stability and have that forever. There's always going to be the next thing that's going to come at you and come at you. And so I've been reminded yet again that this has been the history of, you know, really, I think of women's experiences. This has been the history, and that Teresa Uria, the other women in the story, that didn't, you know, sort of put a nice clean box around what they let their lives become.
All right. That is Robin Foster, author of the book Grit and Ghosts, Following the Trail of 8 Tenacious Women Across a Century. Robin, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
All right, that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. And we always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think, story ideas, things happening in your world. We are at the show at kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.